listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting to us from Managua, Nicaragua.
Yeah, the most important news over the last couple of days has been the incredible result in Venezuela from the point of view of the government and the governing United Socialist Party of Venezuela.
Yep.
And although the results are obviously an overwhelming victory, and they won 300 out of what was it, over 300, of something like 330 municipalities in those municipal elections, including 23 of the 24 state capitals. I think that's, is that the right number?
Yeah,
it's
that's
either
right.
22
yeah.
or 23.
Yeah, it was a remarkable victory, yeah.
Yeah, and also in the rerun of the election for the governorship of the state of Zulia, which was the governor who was elected for the opposition back in whenever it was October, was that when the elections were October? I think it was October. Refused to recognise the authority of the National Constituent Assembly, and so the National Electoral Authority called for a new election in the state of Zulia, which was won by the government candidate, the PSUV candidate. So that means that. And I think the government now have, what was it, 18 or 19 of the governorships? And now they've got over 300 of the municipalities.
Yeah, they have 308 out of 335 municipalities.
So that's, you know, that's in terms of having an advantage in terms, an administrative advantage, and to setting up a base for next year's presidential elections, assuming that the government is able to manage the continuing economic crisis in a way that gives people more confidence and security. I mean, their basic economic well-being.
Yeah.
It looks as though President Maduro and is likely to be able to get re-elected, because unless the Venezuelan opposition really pull themselves together over the next 12 months, and they have nothing to offer voters in Venezuela. And one of the things about these municipal elections is that Luis Almagro, the completely discredited Secretary General of the Organization of American States, called on the opposition parties not to take part in the municipal elections. And he's also been trying to stop them from, or urge them to not take part in the dialogue, the negotiations with the government that have been taking place in the Dominican Republic over the last few weeks. And I think there's another bout of those negotiations scheduled for December the 15th. But the opposition can't even agree on that. They can't agree whether they're participating in the dialogue or not.
Yeah.
They can't agree whether they should follow Almagro's advice or not. Now, and the Justice First and the Popular Will opposition parties and the Democratic Action Party. Democratic Action Party did relatively well in the elections for the governorships, but they decided not to participate in the municipal elections, which is very strange. Anyway, and they because their tactic appeared to be to differentiate themselves from the more extreme elements in Venezuela's opposition so as to get some kind of political advantage going into 2018 and heading for the national presidential elections at the end of 2018. And then they changed their policy and decided not to participate in the municipal elections. That's the Democratic Action Party now. And the fact that the opposition, the main opposition parties, decided not to participate in those municipal elections obviously had some kind of very serious effect in terms of the results. But even if they had participated, they are likely to have suffered a similarly demoralizing defeat to the defeat that they suffered with the elections in the governorships back in October.
Yeah, it looks like the numbers actually look almost identical. You had about a 47% turnout this time, 9 and change million voters, and, you know, an overwhelming majority of them voting for PSUV. And so if you had the other, you know, say 40% who would show up for an 85% turnout or whatever, you would have had a majority that still went for the government, and a significant one, something that would most likely mirror what happened in the gubernatorial, you know, elections and the governor
exactly. And that confirms what you and I have been reckoning over the last few months in every one of these electoral exercises, that the real support of the Venezuelan opposition is between 4 and 5 million, and that's their ceiling.
That's right. And there's something else, too, that's, you know, going forward, this is going to be very important. Winning the municipal elections like this, and as it turns out, as we said, they end up with better than 300 out of 330, or more than 90% of the municipalities are going to be under their control. The problem with the economy has been the distribution network, which has been in the hands of the domestic bourgeoisie, who have been using it to thwart distribution of goods. And decision to put the distribution in the hands of the government, local governments, essentially, because this is a local enterprise that you'd be talking about in terms of distribution outlets and warehousing and local transportation, means if all of these local governments are in the hands of PSUV, the opportunity for wrecking is going to be completely, you know, mitigated. And so going forward, it appears that they're poised, you know, PSOV is poised very well to, you know, solve the problem that they've had with the with economic disruption.
Yeah, I know. As I said earlier, it gives them a huge practical administrative advantage.
Yep.
And the other thing about those elections is that they had foreign election observers from various organizations, the main one being the Committee of Latin American Electoral Experts, which is a very prestigious electoral observation body in Latin America, with people from across the political spectrum. And they certified the results as being very free and fair. And then, so if you take that into account and look at the overall situation in Venezuela and compare it to what has happened in Honduras over the last couple of weeks, the comparison is extremely negative for, obviously, for the regional right wing and for the Honduran government in particular, and for its masters, its puppet masters in the United States, in the White House,
right,
and in the State Department.
Yeah, or in Langley or wherever.
Yeah. So, and what's happened in Honduras is that, as our listeners probably know very well, the elections were held on whenever it was, November the 26th, and the initial results gave a very clear lead, a decisive lead, and what one of the electoral tribunal magistrates described as an irreversible lead to the progressive candidate Salvador Nasralla. And then mysteriously there was this long hiatus in the count, and when it restarted, all the votes started favoring the government the sitting president, who was standing for re-election, Juan Orlando Hernandez, to the point where he eventually overtook the progressive candidate Nasralla, and subsequently a massive protest in the street, an extraordinary police strike, supposedly because they didn't want to repress the people, but I was always very skeptical of that claim. And now they seem to be back to business as usual. And there have been many deaths. I've seen reports of 17 deaths and hundreds of injured over the last couple of weeks as a result of government repression against peaceful demonstrators protesting the electoral fraud. And even the European Union and even the Organization of American States election observers have said that the elections themselves took place in an atmosphere of great tranquility and civic spirit, but the count has been a complete betrayal of the trust that Honduran people put in their electoral authority. And so election observers agreed a special count, an escrutinio especial, they called it, which finished over, I think, over last weekend, and just confirmed the result. And of course, the special count, the special scrutiny of the votes, was as vitiated as the original count. I know there were no corrective measures to make good the failings in the count originally held by the Honduran Electoral Authority. And it remains to be seen what the OAS and European Union observers will say, because they seem to be the ones that have most prestige. But what they should have done from the start is say, this count is hopelessly flawed and vitiated. We need new elections. That's what they should have said from the start. Let's see what they eventually end up saying. But I suspect that the crisis will be allowed to drag out. And this is how things are done in Honduras and have been done in the past. In the 2005 elections, in which Mel Zelaya ended up after an incredibly convoluted set of negotiations and miscounts and all kinds of shenanigans, Mel Zelaya came out as the successful candidate in those 2005 elections. And I expect a similar process to take place now. They're not going to respect the will of the Honduran people. And are the Honduran opposition capable of mobilizing sufficient support over sufficient time to defeat government repression? Well, if you look at what happened after the 2009 coup, they tried really hard, and they were just repressed consistently for months. And I don't see any sign on the part of the Honduran authorities or their United States supporters, government supporters, the Trump administration and his State Department, that they are inclined to do anything different this time. I mean, they're likely to support in a low-key way Juan Orlando Hernandez's fraudulent electoral win. And I am not optimistic about a significant change in the current situation.
Yeah, they had, they're in the streets still. There was massive protests just yesterday. It appears that the people are not buying this theft. And so I don't know where it's going to end up, but it appears that there's going to be some sort of a confrontation over this, and it's not settled yet.
No, not at all. It's not settled, but it's likely to just be allowed to drag on, with the opposition holding demonstrations and rightly claiming fraud, and the electoral authority just digging in its heels and saying, "Well, we've done a recount," and they'll do another recount and they'll get the same result until the election observers, and which I don't think is going to happen, until the international election observers in the European Union and the Organization of American States say this is a farce, the electoral count was completely corrupt and vitiated and fraudulent, we need new elections with a completely different count system. And until they do that, it's just going to drag on, and it'll be just like 2009, with lots of suffering on the part of opposition supporters, lots of frustration for opposition supporters, and the government's just going to sit it out.
Yeah.
So, and if you compare that with the situation in Venezuela, I mean, where are all these claims of democracy and support for electoral fairness? And electoral integrity. Where are all these people who've been so critical of the Venezuelan system, which has shown itself to be incomparably superior to the corrupt system in a U.S. government client like Honduras?
Or in the United States, for that matter.
Oh, right, sure. We probably shouldn't go there because it's such a complicated and very clear condemnation also of the United States electoral system. But and so that's that for people in Latin America. Let's go back to the question that we've discussed a couple of times. Why is this election so important? Why do people care? And I continue to believe that the reason that the United States is likely to continue to support Juan Orlando Hernandez is because they can't afford to lose Honduras in the Organization of American States or at a continental level as a voice on their side condemning Venezuela. And it's absolutely crucial for them that Honduras does not become led by a progressive government that is likely, if not to support Venezuela, at least to abstain from votes against it. You know, and that to me seems to be the fundamental reason why the United States government is being so supportive, and it has been supportive, of Juan Orlando Hernandez.
Yeah, I don't even know where to begin with this. You've got so many moving parts. One of the reasons that the election in Venezuela is so important, of course, is we've been looking at Venezuela as being sort of the linchpin of a lot of the activity in Latin America that's tended towards consolidation of economic, cultural, political alliances, certainly unity in support of the right of self-determination of the region, sort of an integration of the economic, including even contradictory political forces based on the strength of the economic relations that were developing. And that, in turn, is the environment from which comes Brazil, arguably the largest economy, certainly the most populous country in Latin America, which is one of the BRICS, which is a part of this global movement towards exactly those same things. And so, you know, pulling, kicking out Venezuela as one of the legs of this in Latin America is, you know, also kicking out one of the legs globally. Honduras is, you know, an important key part of that exact movement in Central America, and which is one of, you know, you have Central America, South America, and the Caribbean, essentially. And so, you know, doing the same, it certainly interdicts the possibility of constructing such an alliance from, say, the Rio Grande all the way through the rest of the hemisphere.
It's absolutely crucial for the United States to keep control of the Honduran government.
And then there's the huge military base, of course.
The big military base. But another aspect of that, perhaps someone might describe it as the converse of that, is that what's happening in Honduras is a very serious image setback for the right wing, because countries like Colombia, Mexico, Peru, Argentina, the current usurper right-wing government in Brazil, they've all ganged up on Venezuela, attacking it on the grounds that it's anti-democratic, that the Maduro government is in effect a dictatorship, and so on and so on. And but the recent elections in Venezuela, contrasted with what has happened in Honduras, gives the lie to that completely and makes it very difficult for people to come out with similar claims, you know, after the events in Honduras and the way the Organization of American States has been completely discredited in terms of, you know, if you look at it in realistic terms. And the Organization of American States' behavior in Honduras has been pathetic. And that has effects on the morale of the right wing. I mean, they may be able to hold on to Honduras over the next few weeks by hook or by crook, but they know they've suffered a serious electoral defeat.
Right, by crook most likely. And the question that it, you know, obviously provokes is, so how's that conservative restoration going for you?
Well, yeah, sure. And that was always absurd. So with the electoral context in the region dominated by what's happening in Honduras and this tremendous result for President Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, the next electoral exercise will be in Chile, when right-wing candidate Sebastián Piñera has a runoff against the progressive candidate Alejandro Guillier. And although the polls are giving, apparently, and insofar as one can believe the polls at all, the polls in Chile give Piñera a slight lead, I suspect that he's going to lose. And everything depends on how high on two things. How high the turnout is. A low turnout will favor Piñera. If there's a high turnout, and if the left-wing Frente Amplio voters turn out en masse for Guillier, he'll win. You know, it's as simple as that. And so we'll just have to wait and see what happens. Now, and I'm not a great fan of Alejandro Guillier, but I think it's important, very important to note that the Frente Amplio leader, Beatriz Sánchez, has said that she's going to vote for Guillier. And they've left it to open to, they're not making any recommendation to the Frente Amplio supporters which way they should vote. They're saying that they should vote according to their conscience. And that's, in effect, that's saying, you know, vote for Guillier because otherwise Piñera will get in. And I suspect that Piñera will lose, and perhaps by a lot, but so much depends on the turnout. And that's a very big deal from a regional point of view, because although Guillier is unlikely to make a very strong break with the policies of his predecessor, Michel Bachelet, at least he'll be under pressure from the Frente Amplio supporters to perhaps not support Venezuela, but at least abstain. So that, too, is going to be very important at a continental Latin American Caribbean level in terms of future diplomacy, the kind of diplomatic battle between the progressive forces and the reactionary forces, because up until now Michelle Bachelet has been abject in the way that she's strung along with the more extreme right-wing forces in the region. And so we'll see what happens on the 19th. And so shifting from Chile to Argentina, you can see how desperate the right wing is, because there are all kinds, and as you say, there are all kinds of moving parts. And what's happening in Argentina now is that
treason. They're accusing her of treason, and they're trying to stick that Nisman mess on her and that bombing back in the 90s.
Yeah, and so I don't know if you've got time to
yeah, let's develop quickly. It a little bit. Yeah.
AMIA, it was a Jewish or Argentinian organization. I think it was a mutual insurance building. The AMIA building was blown up in 1994. Nobody was ever identified as the perpetrators of that horrible terrorist attack. And I can't remember I think several tens of people died, and there were many dozens injured, as I recall. But that attack has been manipulated by the right wing ever since. And so what the Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Kirchner did during their periods of government was to try and investigate it without being misled or forced off track by United States government pressure or by pressure from the government of Israel. And they were pressing at different times. It's like all of these terrorist incidents that are exploited by the United States government and its allies. At different times, they target different people. So one minute the candidate is X and the next minute the candidate is Y. And depending on what the geopolitical imperatives of the moment may happen to be. And the same thing happened with this AMIA building terrorist attack, until eventually, and the United States tried to pin it on Hezbollah and Iran, and the Argentinian government administrations under Nestor Kirchner and under Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner tried to follow up that investigation. They tried to have meetings with Iran to discuss, you know, what is Iran's point of view of those events. And just for wanting to discuss with Iran, just for wanting to open up a diplomatic channel to Iran, the right wing and the regional right wing, the United States government, attacked Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner.
Right.
Because they needed to pin that as a terrorist attack, to be able to say that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization and that Iran supports international terrorism. And the Argentinian government's decisions to negotiate and talk directly to Iran made nonsense of that, because they were able to demonstrate that the Iranians had nothing to do with it. And so then, among all the convoluted conspiratorial actions from the Argentinian right wing that were conspiring to try and make Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Kirchner look bad, among all that, they instigated a special prosecutor, this guy Nisman, who died in very mysterious circumstances, apparently by suicide. But the Argentinian right wing, led by Mauricio Macri, are trying to suggest that somehow that Nisman was murdered, and that somehow Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her political party and her government were involved in that. So it's really dirty manipulation of judicial, administrative, political processes in Argentina, with a very clear political motivation, and an extremely dishonest and dirty motivation designed to as in everything they do in relation to Cristina Fernandez, designed to smear her, to make her unelectable in any future presidential elections.
Yep.
Now, they failed. They failed in to prevent Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner getting elected to the Senate in the recent legislative elections. And that seems to be have been the trigger for this latest development, which itself has been made to look completely stupid by the former head of Interpol, who explains that the Argentinian government at no point tried to interfere in Interpol's handling of potential accusations related to the AMIA terrorist bombing.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, unfortunately old hat for the U.S., including people should keep in mind the fact that Iran was the only country successfully sued so far in the 9/11 attacks on the United States, because a case was brought against them and they did not recognize the validity of it, so they didn't appear. There was a default judgment in the amount of billions of dollars taken against Iran, which had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. Tony, we got to stop here, and we thank you very much for your time, as usual.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to talking to you again. Let's see how things go in Chile on Sunday.
Absolutely. Yep. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Trust in the mainstream media is at an all-time low, but no one should be surprised, and the media has itself to blame. This sad state of affairs is a self-inflicted wound and actually a conscious business model. The media no longer has an interest in reporting news. Media today propagates ideology. Cross-talking the state of the media, I'm joined by my guest, Eric Alterman in New York. He is a SUNY Distinguished Professor of English and Journalism at Brooklyn College, as well as the liberal media columnist for The Nation. Also in New York, we have Lionel. He's a legal analyst and a news decoder at LionelMedia.com. And in Plymouth, we cross to Patrick Henningsen. He is a journalist, writer, and founder of the news website 21stCenturyWire.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Lionel first. In New York, I'm not going to list all of the mistakes the mainstream media has made over the last few months, because that would take up the entire program and then some. Suffice to say, Lionel, I think it's quite evident that the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, and other news organizations, they're making mistakes because they have a blind hatred for Donald Trump. Their blind hatred is throwing journalistic practices and principles out the window. And this is damaging the information sphere in the United States, and I would say the political process as well. Go ahead, Lionel.
I would venture to say it's an admixture of Trump derangement syndrome in full bloom. It's negligence, it's malfeasance. And also, isn't it amazing and shocking, perhaps, that none of these mistakes ever inure to the benefit of Trump? Or anybody else, or they never deal with Hillary Clinton or those of the so-called left and progressive left or whatever. It's always a unidirectional mistake. There's never, and by the by, the biggest problem right now that is facing this country is not this promulgation and this proliferation, I should say, of sexual dalliances. It's the fact that today's mainstream media, today's Ted Baxter, sock puppet, echo chamber, rancid, odious, ossified media is dead. It's through. It's in the death throes, and it faces an existential threat. That's their problem. And you think they'd be shaping up instead of becoming more negligent.
Eric, let me go to you. That's a very good point to mention. I mean, they should get their act together. But, you know, we still don't know why three different outlets confirmed the same bogus Russia story last week. They just had a retraction or an update. But they didn't explain to the public how they came to that disastrous conclusion across the board. I mean, no wonder people don't trust the media anymore. They're not transparent. Go ahead, Eric.
I find everything I've heard said on this program so far to be ridiculous. I think the mainstream media are, first of all, the word media is a plural noun. So to talk about the media, you have to make distinctions between which media you're discussing. I think the media you mean, which is CNN, the New York Times, Washington Post, etc., I think they're in an impossible position because they are faced with a president who lies on average six times a day. That's a statistic compiled by the Washington Post. He probably lies much more than that, but those are the lies they've caught using a very narrow definition of lies.
So the mainstream media doesn't lie? The mainstream media doesn't lie? Is that what you're saying?
First of all, well, I'm pretty capable of saying exactly what I want, so you don't have to put words in my mouth.
Well, I'm trying to understand your words.
Fox News lies. Fox News lies. But no, the mainstream media, by and large, certainly the New York Times, Washington Post, and other reputable outlets never lie on purpose. They make mistakes. But it's very hard to cover a president who is purposely undermining American democracy, who, again, lies on average six times a day and doesn't care that he's caught lying. Let me ask you a question. Just take one for instance. Donald Trump repeatedly tweeted that Barack Obama wiretapped him on purpose. Now, the Justice Department found that was not true. Donald Trump apologized
but there, there
for
seem,
that?
But there
he,
seems to be overwhelming evidence that he was
let
surveilled.
Me ask you a
he was
Donald
over,
Trump,
surveilled.
I'm not
okay.
done. I'm not
All right,
done.
Let me go
I'm
to,
not done.
Okay.
No, there's no evidence
well,
for that.
No, I said before this
what
program,
about,
sorry,
what about Donald
I
Trump?
Don't want to have any filibustering.
Let me finish one
because
more
I believe in freedom
I'm
of speech.
Not
and I would like to hear the freedom of speech from Patrick in Plymouth. Go ahead, Patrick. React to what you've heard so far.
Yeah,
what about
First of all, I'm gonna disagree with what Eric said about defining the terms. I'm gonna say media as a singular entity because when it comes to all things Russian
it's grammatically
or all things
incorrect.
Trump, the media, it might be grammatically incorrect, but it does represent the reality of the situation, which is that media is completely together in lockstep, reading off the same hymn sheet on all things Russian. And if you want to talk about the mainstream media, these are all fake news stories from mainstream media. This is just my file for the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN. Granted, CNN's half of this, but this is perhaps my favorite. Pokemon Go was hijacked by Vladimir Putin to mislead Americans. This is a CNN exclusive. This is just one example of many. And to say that what you're doing, Eric, is creating a false equivalency, trying to compare Donald Trump's Twitter tirades to what's supposed to be the Fourth Estate, who has a collective budget, operating budget, of over $10 billion dollars in the United States. All of these mainstream media outlets basically putting out fake news. The CNN WikiLeaks story is quite interesting because the same so-called sources were used apparently by CBS News as well as CNN and others. And you read the email and you could see the date. It was September 14th. So I had the question is, you know, did these sources actually read the so-called evidence, or should it have been done in Braille? Or the CNN's journalists, so-called journalists, are they illiterate? How does this type of mistake come to be? And how is it repeated and passed on to other, laundered through CNN and then on to CBS? CNN uses Twitter to put fake news out and then retracts it.
Let me go to Lionel here. I mean, the story that was just mentioned by Patrick there. I mean, they want to believe in what they say. They jump on board. Is it laziness or is it, you know, what level of intentionality? Because like I said, there's so many of them. I mean, Patrick just held up a whole stack of them. I mean, it seems endless. I can't imagine this would have happened during the Obama administration. Go ahead, Lionel.
Well, at first you have to start off with the idea as evidence, Exhibit A, after all, you have the most lying president. So therefore, anything that happens is somehow outweighed and canceled by the fact that, Trump is a liar. Let's take this week. Now, all you have was a CNN story about Donald Trump Jr. and a WikiLeaks memo or email. And all it did was reading a date correctly. It's all it involved was just reading a date correctly and not say, oh, 414. That's all it was. It was a transposition of numbers. That's all it was. Now, you tell me how Donald Trump's mendacity, and thank you for clarifying that medium is a singular noun and not a plural, but tell me how mendacity,
you got it wrong,
his ability to wax veritas. Could you explain to me how that has anything to do with CNN or somebody else just saying, you know what, we made a mistake? That's all it is.
Eric, do you want to reply to that? Go ahead.
Sure. First of all, I'm not here to defend CNN. I think CNN is pretty crappy. And they did make a mistake, and they did admit it. So journalists make mistakes all the time. It's a very imperfect practice. That's why it's called the first draft of history. The press is going to make lots of mistakes.
David Frum said that.
What you were doing is actually trying to create a false equivalence between the deliberate lies of the Trump administration and its supporters and the mistakes that are part of being a journalist. I'm not saying they don't make mistakes. I'm not saying this wasn't mistake.
No,
CNN
I'm not.
CNN has admitted it's a mistake.
No, I'm not. I'm
CNN
attacking
has
your specious premise.
Has Donald Trump?
No, it's not.
Donald Trump? I'm not done, sir. Can I finish? When has Donald Trump admitted that Barack Obama was born in the United States?
Waiting.
Okay, let's talk about something else.
What day did that happen?
This is very good, Altman. Very good.
Something else. Sure.
Don't talk about what we're talking about now. Bring something else up. Fantastic. Look, I was giving you an example. I was attacking your absolutely baseless claim. You said the problem is, forget the fact that this is fake media. We have the most lying and the most mendacious president there is. That's what you said. I was addressing that. So what do? When you're losing the argument, let's bring up the birther thing. Let's change the subject. Look, I don't know with whom you debate
on
a regular basis.
Listen, fella, that's not what
I
said.
What
I said
is,
you're misrepresenting what I said.
Why?
You're misrepresenting what I said. What I said is that it's very difficult to cover an administration.
Let Eric speak. Go ahead, Eric, go ahead. Go ahead.
I did not change the subject. What I said is the media are not up to the job of covering a president who lies on average 6 times a day and doesn't care that he's caught lying. Will just lie every time he's caught lying. So they're not. That's very difficult to do because you can't fact check every single sentence the president says. So they're going to make mistakes. There's going to be more mistakes. They're going to be serious mistakes. That does not take away from the fact that this president is purposely undermining our democracy and our media. And
hold on.
That stands between.
Yeah. Well. Let me go to Patrick here. It seems to me this really low standards of journalism, that's what's destroying democracy and the faith in the system. That the journalism has to take responsibility for what they do. 40 seconds, Patrick, before we go to the break. Go ahead.
Newsflash, Eric and everybody, politicians lie. Barack Obama, I'm going to close Gitmo as soon as I'm president. And I could get on and on and on those lies. So politicians lie. That's expected. Let me finish, sir. Okay? You can't expect to make excuses for what you call the Fourth Estate. And so it's okay for them to, what you call, make mistakes. They're fabricating news stories. They're fabricating sources. They are literally making up news and putting it out on the cycle. There is no evidence of Russian collusion. 18 months later, there's nothing. Fake news for 18 straight months on all the major networks and newspapers. That is the fake news crisis. It is not Donald
Trump's
Twitter finger.
All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the state of the media. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Eric in New York. Eric, I think you at least concede that the liberal mainstream media has it out for Trump. And I think that's why they're making all of these mistakes, because they have a certain goal, and anything that they can get their hands on or even make up, they're going to employ because they think they're morally correct. They think they're doing the right thing. I actually believe that they think that they're doing the right thing. But what bothers me is what we said in this program is it damages the profession of journalism in the process and the trust people have in the media. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, first of all, I concede nothing you just said. To go back to the previous point, I happen to have written my doctoral dissertation at Stanford University on presidential lying, on the history of presidential lying. I published a book called When Presidents Lie, and I'm writing a second book on presidential lying right now for Basic Books. Not all presidents lie. It's true, most presidents
lie.
Certainly most modern presidents
lie.
May I finish? May I finish? May I finish?
Obama won't be in your new book. I guarantee that.
Eric, keep going, Eric. Keep going.
Well, the example you brought up, sir, is not a lie. Obama said he would close Gitmo. He tried to close Gitmo, and Congress wouldn't let him. That's not a lie.
We're
that's
still waiting.
That's a failed policy.
We're still waiting 9 years later.
May I finish? You're waiting for Obama to close Gitmo.
Please, I want to know when it's going to close.
President Hillary Clinton. May I finish?
Yeah.
May I finish?
Sure.
Now, to answer the moderator's question, the quote-unquote liberal media are not liberal. The mainstream media is in the business of making money. That's why during the campaign, Donald Trump was given billions of dollars in free media with his speeches being carried live, his phone calls being carried live, where he lied consistently, lied about virtually everything he said. As again, he has told, according to the Washington Post count, believe.
Yeah, but Eric, this program is about.
You're not letting me finish.
Well, no, because you're going into the weeds again. This program is about professional journalism. We don't need to hear the crickets on these other topics. Okay, I mean birthers and all this is fine. What it's about the professionalism of journalism, and they are breaking their bond with the public. The polls show it, okay? Let me go to Lionel. Last year, CBS News said, the president said, Trump is good for CBS for exactly the same reasons that Eric mentioned here. It's not about getting the story right. It's about the kind of propaganda that you want to propagate and make money off of it. That is a disgrace to journalism. You should stop calling it journalism then. Lionel, go ahead.
This is going to be one of the greatest interviews, discussions ever. Because this fella does exactly what everybody hates. He is the personification of that which we hate, prevarication and not admitting, which is true and obvious to anybody. The issue that Peter asked was, what do you do about not fake news, not bias, because we can argue bias all day long, but what about when they just get it wrong? Then they just got it wrong. That's the framework, Mr. PhD. That's the framework. So what this fella does is, instead of answering that because he can answer it, he's smart enough to realize, I have no answer. Let me throw in something about Trump being a liar. And that is the reason why the mainstream liberal media is dying. It's in its last throes. And everybody knows it. And you, sir, are Exhibit A. And I present to the jury, that is the world, see, this is what it's about. You can't even answer the question. All you had to do was just concede that the duty of journalism is just to get it right. Would it have killed you, fella, to say that? But you can't do it because we got you in this one. And
CNN made a mistake and they admitted it.
Patrick, let me go to Patrick here. But Patrick, one of the things, let's deal with facts here, unlike the liberal media that make things up, all right? I mean, it was 17 intelligence agencies. It's assumed as a fact that the DNC was hacked, but the FBI never looked at the servers. The DNC didn't allow that. What I'm getting at is that you keep hearing on CNN, MSNBC, et cetera, et cetera, they keep repeating the same unsubstantiated claims as if it is a law of gravity. And you never hear anybody pushing back there. This groupthink, this is exactly what it is. It's groupthink. And it's turned into a cult. It's a religious cult now they have. And anyone that violates it is considered a heretic. Go ahead, Patrick. Like us, I suppose.
Yeah, first I will agree with Eric that it's not a liberal media exclusively per se. There happens to be a kind of a liberal hysterical insurgency right now in the mainstream media, but CNN will read straight off of Pentagon briefings or State Department briefings, and the New York Times will do the same, straight off the party line on certain issues. So they really are there to protect the establishment, whether that's a liberal or a conservative establishment or a military industrial complex establishment. You just have this hysteria going on. The problem problem with the all journalistic standards have been thrown out the window in the last 18 months, because when it comes to anything Russia or Trump, but especially Russia, this is much bigger than Trump, by the way, this is as a geopolitical scope to it, it's tell, don't show. So the accusations get rolled out, but they don't actually have any evidence. Can someone find me one piece of evidence that Russia hacked the U.S. elections, or even hacked the DNC, or colluded, or meddled, or anything? Nothing. The Facebook bot story that everybody ran with, from the Washington Post to the New York Times, that was, if you really drill down on that story, that was a case of the Obama administration colluding with a Silicon Valley company, Facebook. Senator Warner from Virginia did multiple trips over there to try to extract some story about Russian bots. Finally, Facebook capitulated and gave him a narrative about all these Russian bots purchasing Facebook ads. It's a laugh, and that dominated the United States mainstream, all networks, news cycles for I don't know how long, weeks, okay? That is a fake story. That is a fabricated narrative. It's designed for a specific political purpose. The problem with political journalists and biased partisan journalists, and Eric, I think you, unfortunately, you do fall into that category, is that you're good for the party, but you're really not good for America, because you're picking one side and you're letting the people who are singing your song off the hook every single time. That is the problem.
Okay, let me go to Eric. I mean, Eric, we had David Frum from The Atlantic. There's the same man that brought us WMDs in Iraq, coined the phrase axis of evil. Okay, yeah. And he in The Atlantic was on CNN, and he said about this story that the networks got wrong on this emails, WikiLeaks to the Trump campaign. He said, mistakes are precisely the reason that people should trust the media. Okay, try to swallow that. It's the process of bringing truth to light. I mean, this has got to be the most Orwellian thing I think I've ever heard in media. Okay, because we're wrong, people should trust us. What the hell is he talking about?
Well, I'm not here as David Frum's representative, but I imagine that you're probably taking that out of context. As
no,
virtually
no, not at all. I took it exactly from. I wrote
wait,
it out.
I don't
my,
get it.
See, then,
I don't
okay,
get it.
You
get
just
it.
Dismiss it. You
may
dismiss
I,
it.
May
you,
I
oh,
address
out
the
of context.
Point. I don't get it.
Okay, really?
No,
I mean,
yeah, it probably is. But may I address your point? CNN, which I'm not here to defend, I think they do a crappy job, but CNN apologized for its mistake. When
it didn't
Donald
explain to its viewers why it made that mistake.
Lies.
It did not explain.
That's my point.
No transparency. They demand it from
so
everybody else. They demand
mistake,
it from Donald Trump, but they give their viewers no transparency after what they've been doing for 18 months. Okay, never any transparency.
I'm not here to defend CNN.
I'm not asking you to
me.
Be their lawyer.
I don't care what they do.
I do. Yeah. I care what the media does. I think as journalists, we have a responsibility. You have a degree in it, right, of journalism. I think you know what kind of responsibilities go along with the profession.
No,
Lionel, go ahead,
PhD.
Jump in. Go ahead.
I don't have a degree in journalism.
You know,
so that's another mistake
it would
you
have
just
been
made.
Better.
Maybe you want to apologize for that.
I apologize, okay? I made a mistake. See, a real journalist
good
can
job.
Do it. A real journalist can do it, okay? I don't have to carry water for CNN or anybody else.
I'd like
else.
To meet one here.
Go ahead, Lionel.
Bad, Peter. Bad. Bad. Now, what could have been done was originally, what this fella could have done, this fella could have said, look, we live in a different world right now. It's a 24/7 machine. It's this runaway train. It's this monster that you got to feed constantly. The days of Cronkite, the days of being able to sit around in your office and luxuriate until 6 o'clock and double and triple check, that's a part of the problem. Maybe there's a zealousness, maybe there's a part of bias. He could have answered that. That's a real problem, because it's the immediacy. It's the days of social media. It's the fact that citizen and civilian journalists and alternative media and foreign media are chomping at the bit, all right, and chomping at the heels of these people. I understand that. Now, but that could have been done. But instead, and this is the point, and I hope, Peter, that somehow everybody remembers this and just takes this fella's comment and just says, this is the problem. It's always Trump. Even when you could have very easily said, okay, look, I'll make a concession. Look, the problem is that, no, even then, we don't give an inch. The same thing with Russia. Even though right now we've been talking about this story and not one person in any medium
or the media collectively has ever been able to say, here is the best evidence of any kind of collusion or changing the votes or whatever, even though that's never been done. They don't miss a beat, and they don't give in, and you just keep forward. That's the problem. And when in doubt, when your back is against the wall, when you have absolutely nothing to say,
okay, Lionel, let me jump in here. Let me give Patrick the last word. Let me give Patrick the last word. I think one of the interesting things in this information war that's going on is that how the mainstream media allows itself to be played by Trump every single day. He's calling the shots. They loathe him, but he's actually determining the news cycle, and they cannot accept that. Okay, and I think that's one thing that they need to get their head around. Go ahead. Last few seconds, Patrick. Go ahead.
Sure. Whether it's the fake dossier put out by BuzzFeed and echoed by CNN and all these other sort of fake stories about Trump, and Donald Trump has a right to go to Twitter at that point and defend himself, and I would do, anyone else would probably do the same if they're in his position, whether he's a pathological liar or not.
Okay, I'm Patrick, on that, I'm very spirited discussion, gentlemen, but we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Plymouth, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.